All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum.
Stay on target.
Maximum. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the Read Rothbard podcast. We are back at it again, and it is just before election time. This is our final episode before the upcoming most important election of the century, or whatever the bullshit term is these days. How you doing there, Robert?
It's either going to be World War III or not World War III. Who knows? But that's what all the fear-mongering is saying. So life is going great.
Yeah, good to hear. Good to hear. Our last episode was about Red Dawn, and now we're going to switch it up and do maybe two in one, like a two-bagger, with Interstellar, which is an actual science fiction film, and Before the Flood, which is, well, a science fiction film.
Yeah, I mean, they take, you know, their view, well, there wasn't a whole lot of science in there, but there's a whole lot of doom and gloom predictions that weren't really based on, they're based on science-ish stuff. So, yeah, I think it's fair to call it a science fiction film.
Yeah, scientistic, maybe.
Scientistic, there you go, that's a good word.
Yeah, and Halloween just happened, and the Cubs just won the World Series, and so there's all sorts of things going on. Speaking of things going on, we at readrothbard.com have books, lectures, this podcast, a bunch of articles and things like that. We've also got links for Amazon. We've got a bookstore. We've got a new lecture series for Enemy of the State that's now posted. It's a private seminar with Murray Rothbard. It's 5 hours long and broken up into 7 parts. And it's really cool because he starts at the very beginning. He assumes that you don't know anything about economics and builds from there. And it's quite an interesting listen. So, yeah.
You say so.
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to sort of give a sneak preview of is we are affiliates of Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. And I've caught wind that there might be a Black Friday special for that weekend. And so if you do have an interest in that product, and I vouch for it, it's very good, wait until right after Thanksgiving and click on our link to buy it, because he's also running a contest. So, you know, you'll help us out a little bit, and you'll help yourself out a little bit because you'll save some coin, you'll get a good product, and we'll get a little back and forth. So good stuff. I just wanted to let you know that that is on the horizon, just a few weeks away.
Yeah. Anything else you want to plug, Daniel, before we get into this?
No, nothing in particular, though. You know, right before the call, we were talking a little bit of the Cubs and the upcoming election. You were starting to tell me some stories about that. So why don't we just start there, and then we'll make our way into the movies.
Yeah, so I was telling Daniel just before the call, and he was like, oh, man, this is really good content. And I said, really? And he goes, yeah. And I go, okay. So this is what you get. So I was watching the World Series last night, Game 7. I'm not a big baseball fan, but it's kind of a historic event, the Cubs winning the World Series after a 108-year curse. If either team have won, I mean, the Indians hadn't won since 1948, so that's a bit of a stretch also. But anyway, I knew going in, I mean, I don't watch TV out here. I'm out in the sticks. I don't have a TV, but my neighbors kind of do. I mean, you get like an internet broadcast and you still get commercials and that sort of thing. So I knew that there would be political ads, just every chance you get, there's going to be, I mean, the world was, or, you know, a large chunk of the country was probably watching that game. So you knew it was prime time to get your Trump and Hillary ads in. And there were, spoiler alert, a ton of Hillary and Trump ads and a couple other, you know, local ads and whatever thrown in for kicks. And they all sound the same. Hillary Clinton, blah, blah, blah. You know how they go. But one ad particularly kind of caught my attention because it was an attack ad from Trump. about how Hillary Clinton went into the White House, you know, worth maybe a few $100,000 or something like that. Not super rich. But then now is multi-millionaire through all the crony means and scandals and whatnot. And I thought, you know, fair point. It's true, right? But the backlash, and I'm going to say the people I was hanging out with were probably Hillary supporters. Don't know about everybody in the room, but the main kind of rumble was that Trump was kind of being a hypocrite, pointing out that she was a millionaire, because Trump is multi-millionaire as well. But from my point of view, I'm not sure that everybody is looking at it from the legitimacy of how you accumulate wealth. There's a big difference between accumulating wealth in the public realm and in the private realm. In the free market, the only way you can get wealthy is to provide value. But there's this idea, and it's like this communistic, socialistic mindset that in order to get wealth, the capitalist exploits his workers. And also the idea that, and this is true, that corporations essentially write their own legislation and kind of bend the rules to suit themselves better. And this is true all over the place. Large corporations will lobby governments to essentially write legislation to better suit their own interests at the expense of their competitors. It happens everywhere. That's due to the corrupting nature of government and the desire for basically to gain the system as best you can to best suit your stockholders. There's just a huge difference there. I'm not saying that Trump hasn't done some of that, but to my knowledge, I don't know that he has essentially written a whole bunch of legislation. I know there was one case of eminent domain that he did. I'm not saying he's a choir boy, but to say that the two are equivalent is a gross thing to say. To make money in the free market where you're creating a service that someone is voluntarily paying you for versus the graft and corruption and the cronyism that comes from the Hillary Clintons of the world getting rich. It's a huge difference. People are paying her millions of dollars to talk at a fundraiser or a dinner or what have you, not because she writes such great speeches, but because they expect political favors in return. It's just a way to get around the backroom briefcase of cash that less smooth criminals do. So that's my little story on that. Daniel, if you have any points to add, now would be the time.
No, yeah, I think that's a pretty big distinction that a lot of people don't make, as your example points out, that it sounded to me like they were saying, well, they're both rich, so, you know, what's he complaining about?
Right.
But you're right. I mean, there's only a couple of ways to make money. It's provide value, provide a service that somebody voluntarily purchases, or to use coercion and theft, you know? And I believe that one primarily used the former and the other one primarily used the latter.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the episode to do it on, but there is an argument from the communist side, specifically the anarcho-communist side, where the capitalist exploits the workers because they control the means of production. And there are some really good Facebook posts. I'm putting really good in quotes. I don't know if we're ready to do that segment yet, but when it does happen, I'd like to nominate some of those kind of posts about the anarcho-communists and how exploitative it is for someone to, you know, go into a contract with another person in exchange for services.
Yeah, I mean, so long as it's voluntary, we're cool with it. Apparently, incomes think that somebody has a position of power over the other, and so therefore there's an element of coercion there. But their solution to that is to then use violence to coercively, you know, steal the means of production. So it doesn't seem like that's an actual solution at all, and it's an imagined problem, which kind of related to the topic of our show today, isn't it?
Indeed. So how do you want to do this, Daniel? You want to start with the sci-fi movie or the sci-fi movie?
Well, I've got Interstellar down first because that was the one I watched first, and then I've got the Before the Flood. And I've got notes on both, and so it might be of interest to just start going through that. Though, before we do, and I know this disjoints the whole podcast, so I apologize to our five listeners now, but I do have a couple of other comments to make about the election and Halloween.
Oh, snap.
So since we're talking election, I find it humorous that I see articles in the media, and they're all trashing Trump, and it seems like they're digging really deep because they're posting headlines like, report, Donald Trump used dubious tax avoidance scheme in 1990s, semicolon, method later outlawed.
Yeah, so legal means at the time.
And that's their headline. That's their dirt. This guy
dirt.
Used...
Donald Trump obeys law. It's one way to write that headline.
Yeah, guy uses legitimate at the time means to mitigate how much is stolen from him.
Yeah.
And that's their thing. And then on the other side, the Hillary side, I thought this was cute. So I had read somewhere that if you do a Google search and then you allow autocomplete to happen, so you put somebody's name in and you put his, you'll see suggestions. And so I tried it for Hillary, and it was like, Hillary Clinton is, and it was like, an awesome person, or is dead, or, you know, just some kind of innocuous things. And that was the Google autocomplete. So then I tried it in Bing and Yahoo, and I know people don't really use those anymore. But if you do the search in Bing or Yahoo, you get Hillary Clinton is the Antichrist. Hillary Clinton is a criminal. Hillary Clinton is a liar. So it certainly seems as if Google has scrubbed the results in the autocomplete to make it cleaner, you know, make it more friendly, shine a better light on Hillary versus the other competing search engines. I don't know if this applies to also Trump. I kind of doubt it, but it's also probably harder to police the Trump searches because there's so much negative media about him. So that might skew the results of the autocomplete algorithms. But I just thought it was kind of cute to see that.
It is, and I just watched a debate on whether libertarians should vote for Trump or not, and it all was a bunch of back and forth pragmatic arguments between two libertarians that are notoriously, I don't know, somewhat pragmatic. And did I have a point? Was I just start talking without knowing what I was going to say? I think I did. Sorry, everybody.
Comedy gold right there, folks. Well, you're talking about the Reason editor and Walter Block?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, it basically boiled down to they both suck, hold your nose. In swing states, you know, vote for Trump because he's better than Hillary. But in definitely blue or definitely red states, then vote for Gary Johnson to try to accumulate some momentum in the national scene so that libertarian ideals will at some point enter the mainstream discourse or some bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah, vote libertarian in the purple states, but in blue states, vote Trump.
No. It was in purple states, vote Trump, because those are the swing states.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah,
you're
if Hillary's definitely going to win, then vote Gary. And if Trump's definitely going to win, then vote Gary. But in the areas where it's maybe, maybe not, then vote Trump.
Right. So, yeah, it's a very pragmatic argument. And I don't know, whenever you get two pragmatic guys going back and forth, like I said many times, it's just, eh. I mean, he makes an okay point, then the next guy makes an okay point. you never make any headway.
Yeah.
It seemed to be, are you afraid of World War III? Vote Trump. But then there's all these horrific things about Trump. So then vote Johnson. I don't know. I ended up going... Yeah, I'll stick with my principles. Thanks a lot. But it was kind of amusing to watch, I suppose.
Yeah. And I like how Block kind of went after him at the end because he had the forum to do it. He had 5 minutes left in his closing remarks. So he went after Gillespie about how he had misconstrued the controversy that the New York Times had presented Block as supporting slavery, and Gillespie had written in a Reason article that he was ashamed of Walter Block, and so Block went after him in this, and it was kind of cool to see that.
I don't think I've gotten to that part yet, so I can't comment, but...
No, you in the slow download.
Yeah. I'm out here in the stick, man. I don't got no data.
Yeah, so it's way at the end during the closing remarks.
Mm.
It's not exactly the most civil thing, but...
Well, yeah, I was surprised the whole debate was very uncivil. I mean, Block was kind of complaining and whining about Gillespie talking over him and interrupting him, which I suppose is fine, but it got kind of personal, which
yeah.
is a little bit on the annoying side. But at the end of the day, I don't know. I like Dave Smith's comedy at the beginning. That's probably the best part. All the pragmatic back and forth didn't really impress me much. Of course, it rarely does. But when I think Gillespie said that libertarians should be pragmatic and principled, I would say more principled than pragmatic, but whatever.
Yeah. Now, Block, I think, had some legitimate complaints because there was an agreed-to format. You know, you get a moment to say your thing for X amount of time, and then the other person gets a rebuttal. And Gillespie kept interrupting Block as he was speaking, and that was not the agreement.
True. I would agree with that. That is exactly what happened. So I would say, yeah, Gillespie did betray the agreement.
It's sort of like when you see a Jan Helfelt debate, you know, he doesn't stick to that either. He gets he seems like a guy who doesn't have like social graces to me.
Remind me who this person is you're talking about?
He's the minarchist who says that any attempt to get into an anarchy society will be the new civil war. And he gets like really kind of crazy about it.
So he doesn't think government will just eventually become obsolete. He thinks that there's going to be some sort of a violent situation going on.
Yeah, he thinks government's necessary to keep the peace. Otherwise, anarchy would be a civil war situation where there's warlords with machine guns in the back of their pickups, that whole scenario.
Yeah.
So that's good stuff.
Yeah, because that's the only thing that's keeping us from doing that right now.
Yeah. The threat of, now, I was tempted...
Governments do all the time.
Yeah.
Because there is no higher authority than government, so that's what they do all the time. They're always just winging around in pickup trucks, flying into Mexico with their pickup trucks. All right.
See, as you know, I've got a little Toyota pickup myself, and I was considering Halloween dressing up as a Somalian warlord and putting a fake machine gun on the back, but I decided against it.
Yes, yeah, probably for the best.
Yeah, I'd probably gotten shot myself.
Probably.
But it brings up a Halloween controversy that I saw. It seems as if you can't be anything for Halloween anymore without offending somebody, which is rather ridiculous.
There's this new – I don't know if the offended have always been around, but there seems to be a certain group of people on the Internet that just look for ways to become offended. They go out of their way to see anything, whether it affects them or not, and become totally offended. Like the famous video of the girl and the hula hoop doll. I don't know if you ever watched that or not.
No, not familiar.
Yeah, so I'm not going to retread it here, but for a while there on the Internet, it was big news. There was a social justice warrior who was driving in a car, riding in a Lyft ride, and the driver had a hula doll on his dash.
Oh, that one. Yeah. I've seen that. Yep.
For like 20 minutes about how horrible of a person he was and how offensive that was. So yeah, there's just a group of people, almost an entire class of people that just look for ways to be offended. But go ahead, tell me about your Halloween story.
Yeah. So it's professional victims, you know, they're going out of their way to be victims so that they can get some kind of special privilege, which is kind of funny because they claim everyone else has privilege and that's one of their main talking points. But
yeah.
The thing that I saw was Hilary Duff, who I guess is some semi-famous actress, teen actress.
Yeah, Million Dollar Baby girl, right?
No, that's Hilary Swank.
Oh, I'm getting my Hillary's all mixed up. Hilary Duff. Oh, she's Nickelodeon or Disney Girl or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. And then she was in some teeny bopper movies probably 10 years ago. but I guess she's still relevant in some way. And she and her boyfriend dressed up as a pilgrim and an Indian with a headdress and the whole thing, you know, for like Thanksgiving, like, hey, we're going to be Thanksgiving for Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
People got pissed about this.
Lost their shit.
Lost their shit. Internet went crazy. And she ended up apologizing for, you know, not being
sensitive
racially sensitive or whatever. And she was actually the pilgrim. And it's not even as if she was, like, a slutty pilgrim. No, she was just a, you know, Puritan-looking pilgrim. You know, like, back when we were young, you could dress up whatever you wanted to be. It didn't matter. And as I got older, it seemed like all the girl costumes were, like, slutty versions of whatever. You know, slutty nurse, slutty... like Elvira, slutty flight attendant.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That was the thing. And that was like, quote unquote, offensive. And now it's, if anyone has ever been this thing in the history of the world, you are desecrating them if you dress in any way like them.
Appropriating it. Yeah. And you're being racially insensitive or something like that.
Yeah. And it goes so far as the next thing I saw after that was white women, are no longer allowed or should not wear what are called nameplate necklaces. So it's like your name in a, you know, gold or whatever on a chain around your neck.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not a white girl thing. It's an urban thing. It's a black thing. I don't even know. But apparently if you're a white woman and you're wearing a necklace with your name on it, you are appropriating culture in some way and offending people and being racist.
We could do a whole cultural appropriation episode, but you remember, it really pisses me off when these bullies attack these people that are, I mean, they're just normal people, and then they go and apologize. It's the apology that really gets me. I like people that are unapologetic and stand up and go, what are you talking about? You're being crazy. Instead, they apologize. Like, remember when that NASA scientist, like, landed a satellite on the moon or on an asteroid, and he was wearing like a shirt that his friend had made him that was like had a bunch of like scantily clad women on it.
No, but this sounds good.
Yeah, so he was being interviewed about, you know, what a great achievement it was to land a probe on an asteroid or whatever.
A probe on Uranus, in Uranus.
Yeah, exactly. And he was wearing the shirt that his friend's wife had made him or something like that, and it was like Kula Girls or, I don't know, Bathing Beauties or something like that. It was kind of a garish shirt, but whatever. Wear whatever the hell you want, man. And all these, I don't know, feminist social justice warriors came out and attacked him, saying how horrific it was towards women, how dare he wear this shirt, blah, 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 to the point at which he issued some sort of a teary apology, saying how he had no idea how much offensive he was and all this crap. And I was just like, no, stand up for wearing a shirt, man. Who cares?
Well, Pepe the Frog is now considered a racial thing, right?
Well, I haven't really been up on all the Pepe stuff. I've seen it around. I know it's like a big meme thing, and he's being used all kinds of ways. But I guess somebody did ban it for being a racist icon or something like that. You may know more about it than I do.
No, it got classified as a hate symbol. I think maybe the SPLC, don't quote me, but somebody like that. Or anti-Semitic thing, I don't even know. But so here's the beautiful thing, right? So there's all this shit going on about Hillary Duff being a pilgrim and her boyfriend being an Indian. And there's this nameplate thing. And I even actually saw some nameplate necklace comments from leftists saying, whoa, maybe we're taking this social justice thing a bit too far. Which is great, you know, and that actually sparks an idea. Like maybe you take it and run with it. You sort of use their momentum against them as if it's judo and show them how ridiculous their stance really is and then do a regression to get it to where you actually show on a base level what they're actually trying to accomplish with a gun, you know, with violence. And I don't know if that's beyond our ability, but it's an idea. But that segues me into, you know, so Hillary Duff, pilgrim, boyfriend and Indian, cultural appropriation, evil, terrible, must apologize.
Right.
Beyonce
well,
and Jay-Z.
There's a whole movement to, sorry to interrupt you, and I don't mean to break up your flow here, but kind of goes along with the, you know, the Cleveland Indians win the World Series. Well, their logo is a smiling red-faced Indian guy. in the Washington Redskins, there's been a bunch of social justice warrior type stuff to get them to change that. And there's a bunch of people that just call them like the Washington football team or something like that. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I've seen some stuff about that. And, you know, I don't think they're using it offensively personally, but that's my subjective opinion. But
right.
The point I was trying to make is, so you've got cultural appropriation claimed against Hillary Duff and her boyfriend for Pilgrims and Indians. And yet, Jay-Z and Beyonce dress up as a black version of Ken and Barbie, and everyone loves it.
It's clever and smart.
Clever, smart, they win the internet, they win Halloween, whatever the headlines are. But, I mean, what is more white or cracker than Barbie? So if they're going to go around saying cultural appropriation, this and that, social justice, blah, 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 bullshit.
Daniel, you can only be racist if you're white.
Well, that's the thing, right?
You can only culture appropriate if you are the oppressive class.
As we talked about in a previous episode, yeah. That was the claim.
So if you're white, you're racist, and you're the only one that can be racist.
Because racism only exists if it is white people.
It only exists if you are the current top of the heap or whatever. I don't know. Apparently. I don't know how these metrics get made. I don't know how what standard they're using.
It seems to be a moving target.
Yeah, I guess you could just claim that since the majority of people in the United States is white, you know, not even by a whole lot, I guess, anymore, but whatever, I don't care. That means that somehow we're on top just because there's more of us? What are they pointing to when they say things like that? I don't know.
Yeah, what happened to the individual making choices, you know?
We are a collective, Daniel. You need to
learn. I mean, the most oppressed class of people is the individual. It's every individual who is subjugated to the will of some ridiculous collective thought, which is a nice segue into our movies because they are both about disasters that appear to be on such a large scale or magnitude that the only possible solution proffered is collective action on a global scale to solve these problems.
I'm going to offer up a little bit of counter to that, but I'm not going to disagree too much. So Interstellar is a movie done by Christopher Nolan. It's got the flippy robot, like a box rectangle robot, and Matthew McConaughey in the lead. And did they say, I forget, but did they say what year it was? It's something like 2070 or something like that, maybe. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I don't recall. I was watching on my phone, and so if they had a little thing indicating the year, I didn't see it. But it did seem not too distant future.
Yeah, it seemed to be like Nolan watched some documentaries about the Dust Bowl and kind of wanted to pair it up with a kind of post-apocalyptic kind of what would humanity do if the whole world was turned to that kind of idea.
Yeah, and if I recall, McConaughey was on the tail end of the abundance life that we have. So he was doing test flights at the end of what would be today's era, and then the blight started to happen, and so he was no longer a test pilot because there was no need for it.
Right. So, in the movie, you've got this. Let's run down the evidence for it being a kind of a collective, because I don't know if we could say that the movie necessarily says that collective action is the best way to do it, but maybe just that this is the way they chose. Because I'm not necessarily sure they're making it seem like it's a good thing. Because the main characters, especially McConaughey, like he goes into the school, and the school is trying to teach their kids one thing, and he's like, "You're dumb. I don't care about grades. I'm taking my kid out of school, and I'll teach her myself," or something like that. There is definitely some collectivization going on, if you could remember some of those things, Dan.
Yeah, and just, you know, for our listeners, we're going to assume you've already seen this movie, so we're not really going to give a full rundown, and we're not going to worry about spoilers. We assume you've seen it.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about it as if everybody's seen it. So that's just the way we're going to do it.
Yeah, so your question about, like, how is it exhibited that they have a collective solution? I was watching, and I saw that they assign people to jobs at an early age. Like, McConaughey's son doesn't score well on a certain test, so they say, oh, well, you're going to be a farmer then. You're no college for you. You know, the Politburo has deemed that you are best to serve the group as a farmer.
Right.
And so that's the thing that I saw, in that there was a crisis, that there was this blight, and different crops were failing at different, you know, over the course of time. And so now they were down to just corn. And they had some arbitrary test to determine who would go to college and who would, you know, be deemed this position or this job. And I think that was a method of allocating scarce resources. But it was a top-down central planning version of doing it. And to your comment where you're saying, well, they're not saying it's the best way, they're just saying it's the way they chose. Well, I'd argue that demonstrated preference is the best way to determine what people at the time thought was the best thing to do. They chose it because they thought it was best.
Let me ask you a question. Would you say that this movie is pro-collectivization or anti-collectivization?
I think the McConaughey character is the rugged individual who
he's
is
a hero.
He's the hero, and he's counter to the environment of the film, the collective nature of the film. So perhaps he is the true message of the film, and they're showing the hypocrisy and the ridiculousness of the collective response to the perceived crisis.
Right. That was kind of my takeaway. Was that it was more of a dystopian 1984 movie and less of a collectivization is awesome town kind of a movie. Whereas this other movie we saw only showed and offered collectivization type solutions to a perceived problem. But let's continue on with Interstellar if we got any more to say about that.
Yeah, I do a little bit, and then I'm more than happy to go into the what's it called? The Enter the Flood?
Before the Flood.
Before the Flood. Here I am thinking Bruce Lee.
Yes, Enter the Flood.
Enter the Flood. That might be the name of this podcast now, since I've made that faux pas. So back to Interstellar, because I think they're related in this way, in this capacity, in that a wide-scale problem is presented, and the solution that's proffered is the collective central planned response.
Right. And that is seems to be the gut check response to, or at least the given solution to any crisis. And that is the nature of government, is the problem, reaction, solution. Create the problem, react and say that more government intervention is necessary, you know, provide the solution. That's the government model of doing things. And it seems to be that Nolan is basically saying that, yeah, this is the next logical move for government to create even more control, to exert even more control on this global crisis.
Right, and I think that the popular opinion is that when there are large-scale problems such as world wars or the Great Depression or, you know, huge undertakings, that it is government that is the solution. Like the Manhattan Project couldn't have happened without government. The Great Depression was, quote-unquote, solved by government interventions.
Well, now, wait a minute. Hold on.
Even though these
Hold
things
on.
Aren't true, but that's the common belief.
But these are all those things you just said are almost certainly government-caused problems.
Yes. Yes, they are. But I'm talking about the popular opinion, like most lay people who aren't hip to the libertarianism believe the narrative that FDR got us out of the Great Depression or World War II got us out of the Great Depression, that these great works of the Hoover Dam or the Tennessee Valley Authority. What's that?
I was just agreeing with you. Keep going.
Oh, okay. So, like the Hoover Dam and the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Manhattan Project and, you know, solving the Great Depression and all that stuff couldn't have happened without government, you know, efficiently and economizingly solving the problem. And that's what most people believe. I think that's what most people believe. It's what I was taught in school.
Right.
But as we now know...
Well, there's a false sense of... I don't know, what's the fallacy going on here? I'm not sure. But to say that just because that's the way it did happen is the way that it could only have happened, or the only way it could happen in the future, is absolutely false.
Well, and not even that, but the narrative that's taught in school is not even true. Like, FDR and World War II did not get us out of the Great Depression. It was the fact that the war ended and all these government programs, you know, the spending of government went down and all these people returned back to the U.S. and were seeking ways to reintegrate themselves into the society. You know, like, what am I going to do? I got to do this. I got to get this job. I got to do that. That's what brought us back from the Great Depression. It wasn't all these programs and interventions from the government, and it wasn't a war or even preparations for war. All that does is extract from the positive production. It's a negative, you know. It's not an asset. It's a liability.
Absolutely. It's production that is not the preferred choice. It's taking away from the preferred choice.
Right.
But it's not preferred choice production.
Yeah, and Hazlitt's great on this. So if anyone cares to read Economics in One Lesson, and you'll read all about the Great Depression and Tennessee Valley Authority and how the choices were removed from people, so they went to the next thing, and it necessarily is less than what would have been accomplished had people been able to choose voluntarily.
Absolutely.
So back to the Interstellar thing, I just had another funny thing. So when they tell McConaughey that his son did not test well enough to get into college, his response back to them is, well, I still pay my taxes. Like, what are you talking about? I'm not going to get the services that I'm paying for. I'm you know, paying for him to go to college.
Right.
Which I think is kind of cute, you know, as if to argue that he's paying, his taxes are paying for a service that he won't receive, which can be viewed as, if he had not been paying his taxes, then he would not have this argument, and so he would have accepted that his kid wouldn't go to college. Therefore, there's a punishment for not paying your taxes.
Right. This is totally an aside. Maybe not. I don't know. But there's also this idea, and I've seen this in this Facebook posts in this ANCOM and ANCAP debate group, where an ANCOM posted that the only way things change socially is through violence, or like the only way that you can get like these big events, these things to happen, is through violence. And I would just say that a whole lot, yes, violence does change things. The Manhattan Project changed things. World War II changed things. All government does change things. But voluntary interaction changes things a whole lot more. You just take it for granted. You just don't really notice it. I mean, do you really, you get so accustomed to all the things around you, the abundance that's around you, you don't realize the massiveness, the change has been created through voluntary exchange. People like, you know, the great industrialists of the innovators of the world have changed the world massively. And you just reap the benefits. I'm sitting at a computer talking to you, you know, hundreds of miles away. I know I've made this point before, but you could argue that, yes, a massive undertaking happened when the Manhattan Project got done, but massive projects are undertaken and happen every day. You just don't realize it. There's a massive undertaking every day to get a number two pencil to a store, to get a sandwich to the deli, to get every single product that's available for you to purchase at any given time, at your slightest whim, is a massive undertaking. And it happens all the time, constantly, by people all over the globe. It just doesn't get the headlines. You don't see the headline that says, number two pencil, now available in stores.
It's taken for granted.
Yeah, it's taken for granted. There isn't going to be a number two pencil provider is going to go down history like Oppenheimer will. But he has massively changed the world. I don't know. The idea that only violence can change society is obviously false. and the voluntary change that changes the society are much greater and happen constantly and don't get the credit they deserve. That's my point.
Yeah, and I love the ANCOM argument while they're typing on their iPhone or on their computer over an internet hundreds of miles away to complain about how property is theft.
Yeah.
And how they need to seize the means of production. Well, guess what? If you had seized the means of production 10 years ago, there wouldn't be a fucking iPhone.
Yeah. Yeah, they would want to seize the means of production to then run it straight into the ground.
Yep. No reason to innovate. Once you've seized it, there's no reason to improve it.
Right. So we'd all be stuck with whatever level of technology. Anyway, yeah, it's a really dumb argument. But it's fun to debate them.
Yeah, it's fun to shake your head a lot. Smack your head on the desk.
Yeah.
So another thing with Interstellar, which I think was interesting, was that it's revealed that NASA is still in existence, and the taxes that these people pay, you know, assuming that it's covering schools and colleges and things like that, is still being funded, but under the table. Because, you know, they say in the film, you can't openly fund space exploration while people are starving. Even if space exploration in the realm of the film happens to be their only hope of survival.
Then that would be a failure in communication to explain to people that the only hope of survival is to get off the planet. Although I would argue that the movie celebrates human innovation in one aspect of the science aspect of leaving Earth, but not in the aspect of developing a blight-resistant strain of food.
Yeah, I think
they tell a story.
Yeah, and they take the blight as just this unconquerable thing. The only solution is to get off the planet.
Right.
So a plot device.
It is. It's a plot device. If he was being realistic about it, he would have probably been, you know, fighting or telling a story about the bioengineers that are looking for ways to engineer a blight-resistant thing. But he wanted to tell a story about leaving the planet, so that's the way he went. And I don't begrudge the guy. I mean, whatever. You got to tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah, and to even reinforce the point that they didn't want to publicly fund NASA, at least in the open, in the schools that they had, they actually taught that the moon landings were faked in an effort to goad the Russians into spending all of their money on trying to reach the moon and thus bankrupting them. So they made it a Cold War strategy to defeat the adversary by bankrupting them. And, of course, McConaughey's character is like, what the fuck is this bullshit? And they're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So it was kind of cute to see that kind of thing, you know, the propaganda in the schools sort of presented. So I'm sort of being more and more swayed to your position to where when I first watched this movie, I was like, oh, this is just a bunch of collective bullshit. Who wrote this? You know, Paul Krugman, you know, like, we need to prepare for alien invasion to spur the economy. But I think maybe your point of Nolan showing the collective environment as, you know, kind of this foil to the McConaughey individualist character.
Right. Right. Yeah, I can see your point. If you were, I think that happens a lot. Jones is a guy I think that's guilty of that a lot. He was reviewing, I want to say, The Hunger Games for a long time, a while ago, back when those movies first came out. And he reviewed the first movie, and he said how terrible it was and how, you know, this is a bunch of globalist propaganda. And then he reviewed the second one, and he was like, globalist propaganda, third one. And then at the very end, he's like, oh, so these people are actually fighting the power or whatever. I forget exactly. I mean, his review wasn't the same as ours. But he kind of, at the end, he was like, oh, okay, maybe it was just kind of showing how bad government is. I don't know, blah, blah, blah. I think it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to a lot of pop culture saying that it's bad. But I think you really need to pay attention to, you know, who the hero of the story is, who the villain of the story is. Just because you show a thing in a movie, like in my book, there's government people doing horrific things. I'm not saying that that's good just because I'm showing it. My hero is definitely not one of these government worker people. So I don't know why a movie like 1984 gets a pass and is obviously shown as a commentary on Big Brother type government power out of control. And then other movies, maybe they're being too subtle. I don't know. But I think it's important to notice who the hero is of the story and who the villain is and try to really figure out what the person's trying to say. Anyway.
No, I think that's great because, you know, when, like I said, when I was first watching this, I was like, what is going on here? The collective response to this is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. Yeah, I mean, now that you pointed that out, I do see it more in a he's showing the contrast between the two. Like, you sort of have to set the scene and have a villain, and you can't, you know, present the villain without showing bad qualities.
Right. Right, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a pretty effective way to show that the terribleness of, and he doesn't really come out against it super hardcore, but he does show the McConaughey hero character going, what the fuck, man, to these guys. So he did show it a little bit. You know, maybe if I had been writing the story, I probably would have maybe had a little bit more of that in there. But he was trying to tell a story about, you know, love and time and loss and family and that sort of thing.
Quantum physics.
And plus quantum physics.
Yeah.
Plus relativity, you know, whatever.
I thought it was an interesting presentation of, you know, the government is going to decide for you what the best solution is. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of the collective sort of
Absolutely.
Deal. But,
right. Central planning. You get a job. Everybody gets a job, but we'll determine what you're suitable for.
Right. And we're going to, you know, behind your back, go and try to solve this problem so that you'll still pay your taxes. You know, we're not going to tell you that NASA's still running and we're going to do this stuff. And then later in the film, it's, of course, revealed that that was all just a false hope. It was just a chimera. Is that how you say that? Chimera?
Chimera. Chimera. But no, but I think I'm not sure you were paying attention. The false hope was that, are you talking about the equation?
Yeah, yeah. So they still sent people out, even though they knew that it wasn't going to work.
Right. And then they decided that that was the, what's his name? The actor that was in the wheelchair, the old guy. I forget the name.
Michael Caine.
So yeah, Michael Caine knew that the equation wasn't going to work, or they couldn't work without the data from the black hole. And then McConaughey at the end gets the data from the black hole and gives it to his daughter by pushing on the bookshelf. Remember that?
Right, yeah. He's her ghost.
Yeah, he's her ghost. And so then he gave the data to her in the pocket watch. And then that's what allowed her to finish the equation. And that's what allowed the humanity to escape planet Earth on that giant rocket ship or whatever. It was all super vague and just glossed over how it really worked or whatever, of course. But
yeah, the end just kind of like happened. It was weird. Like all of a sudden they're on this spaceship out by Saturn and she comes to visit him and she's an old lady and she dies. And he walks by this like bay that these ships are in and looks at him for a moment. And then he escapes in one of them to go find that girl. That is weird.
Yeah, he kind of glossed over a whole bunch of stuff in order to just kind of wrap everything up. Yeah, he glossed completely over how the equation was able to work and get the people off the planet and how in the amount of time it took, it was like, what, 70 years, I think he said at one point, how they got off and then they're in this giant spaceship orbiting Saturn or whatever. And then how the hell he got out of a black hole. That was the most ridiculous thing out of the entire movie. I was like, all right, how do you get out of the black hole? Given the ridiculousness that he's in this like five or six dimensional space or whatever it was in the black hole that happens to be all space and time that he has access to, but apparently it just allows him access to, or he chooses to only have access to her bedroom or whatever. Anyway, and he could get into the science of it. I haven't looked up what Neil deGrasse Tyson is saying about this movie or any what theoretical physicists are talking about it, but I'd be interested to see the answer as to why McConaughey was able to escape a black hole. That's what I want to know, because light can't even escape a black hole.
Yeah, yeah, I don't pretend to understand it. I'm not a physicist myself. But you brought up a thing where it elapsed over like 70 years or whatever. But he didn't appear to age, and that
right,
was due to some slippage, right? Time slippage, like every
right.
hour on this planet was 7 years on Earth or something like that.
Yeah, so they lost like 20-some years on that water planet, and then they lost some more time circling the black hole, I think they said. And that was, they lost like 70 years, 20 years, and then 50 years or something around the black hole or whatever the numbers were. I don't remember. But yeah,
yeah.
Eventually it ended up so that he was the same age. But that, you know, his daughter back on Earth had aged, you know, like 80 years or whatever it was, or 100 years or something like that. Because she was like, what, 110 or something when she was dying or something like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that reminds me, when they were first talking about going down to the water planet, they knew that 1 hour down there was going to be 7 years on Earth, and so they plan to go down there for just, you know, like an hour. And
right.
They quote, say, think of time as a resource, just like food.
Right.
As if that's like some new novel concept, but, I mean, anyone who understands Austrian economics understands that time is a resource. Like, things take time to accomplish, and so it's always taken into account. There's
yeah.
things like time preference. You know, people prefer present goods to future goods, and they'll pay a premium for that.
Right, and I think it's a misunderstanding of that, which leads to the idea that evil capitalists are taking a greater chunk of the profit, and how evil that is when they're the ones making this huge risk, putting all their capital at risk on the chance that the good they're trying to produce is going to pay off in the market when they finally get it done. Whereas
right, and
aren't they is getting paid right away.
Right, and aren't they providing the means of production, which costs a bunch of money to create? I mean, how productive would these people be without those means of production, you know? Like, to say that labor is the only thing that brings value to it, but then somebody comes up with a machine that can make your labor like 100 times more effective, like, do you get all of that? Or does the machine and the person who took the risk to put that machine together and pay for it also, you know, receive some of the credit for that? It seems to make sense to me.
I don't know if I'll ever understand anarcho-communists. I don't understand. Whenever, like, I'm in this Facebook group where we talk about, you know, ANCOM versus ANCAP stuff, and it's mostly kind of just memes and questions. So some of the questions actually get, you know, answered a little bit, but a lot of time it's just insulting the guy that asked the question. It doesn't seem to be a whole lot of super rational discussion. I'm not sure. I don't have a whole lot of hope of the two ever really coming to grips with their philosophy of ANCOM, really understanding each other. Because I would love to sit down with an ANCOM and actually understand some of these questions you're asking, you really have an answer for these things. But instead, they seem to, whenever you bring up a good point, like what you just did, they'll just say that, you know, capitalism is exploitation and call you like a evil, greedy person or something like that. I don't know. It turns into like some sort of ad hom attack instead of actually answering the question. Like, they'll bring up, oh, yeah, well, in ANCAPistan, you know, you can nuke child prostitutes with your free market nuclear weapons or something like that, you know. It's good times. You should get on there.
Yeah, it sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is. It actually is. It's an entertainment thing. I don't know if there's a whole lot of hope for humanity in that sense, but it's entertaining. I'm not really learning a whole lot about ANCOMs, but yeah, anyway.
Well, it certainly seems...
Should we move on? Oh, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I have one last point on ANCOMs, then we can move on, and that is that meme that was comparing how certain types of people became anarchists, and the ANCAP answer was, well, I started studying some economics and applying some rational thought to the role of government. And then for the ANCOM side, I was like, I listened to a fuckload of Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah. And to be fair, I also listened to a lot of Rage Against the Machine. But going back and listening to Rage Against the Machine, you wish that they had maybe taken a few more economics courses. Because,
yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of just shaking your fist angrily at the man instead of really understanding what's going on.
Yeah, so speaking of ANCOM, so let's get into the Before the Flood, the Leo DiCaprio pick that I think when you sent me a link to it, you said DiCaprio released his global warming scare piece just in time for Halloween.
Yeah, it was. It was about a day before Halloween, wasn't it? I think it was like October 30th or the 29th, something like that.
Yeah, and it's a National Geographic deal too, right?
Yeah, absolutely National Geographic. Now, full disclosure, I don't know. I don't know if in 30, 40 years we're all going to be underwater or not. I obviously, if all the ice caps melted and never refroze in the wintertime, sea levels would rise a whole ton and a lot of people would be displaced and a lot of people would die. But those seem to be doom and gloom predictions and like disaster porn type predictions, and those things almost never come true. But anyway, let's get into it. So Leo DiCaprio, yeah, a couple of years ago when he was filming The Revenant, he started filming this documentary, I guess you could call it, where he flies around the world And I don't know if he's taking private jets, but he was. He was flying around the world. They show him in all these different locations. And he's interviewing various people. I think at one point he interviews some politician in India. At one point he interviews some people who work for the oil industry, I think in like Canada. He interviews like the politician, like the mayor of Miami. And just showing different, I guess, environmental impact places. He showed the in Canada, I believe it's Canada, the sand oil harvesting, I guess you could call it. I don't know what's the exact term. They take the
tar sand.
Tar sand, yeah. And he was complaining that it looked like Mordor, which, to be fair, fairly did. But as we've discussed in the past, these are all public lands that get leased out to companies on a time basis, and they come in and strip what they can out of it. So, I mean, this is another government issue. And then he was also talking about the palm oil industry in, like, Indonesia and all the forests they get taken down for that in order to, you know, make money. It was a whole lot of anti-human, kind of anti-industry talk. And there was, I'll give him a little bit of credit because there was a tiny bit of you can change the way you act, which is perfectly fine for me. If you see a thing that's happening and you disagree with it, then you can change your behavior to not support it. Fantastic. We all vote with our dollars. You can choose to vote your dollars for other things, for more environmentally responsible products. Go for it. Do whatever you want. But where he goes wrong is where his entire solution, except for the tiny little voluntary part where he talks about that, is to institute like carbon taxes and get legislation on the books that cracks down on corporations from doing a certain thing. It also, he talks about a lot of the environmental destruction that's happening, saying that the coral reefs are dying and other things like that, and certain animals are being displaced and dying off. And there is a certain amount of that, no disagreement there, but it doesn't take into account adaptability. The history of the Earth has undergone massive catastrophic changes, catastrophic, far greater than anything a human being could do. And I'm not saying it's not bad for the things that are alive now that are dying. Sure, they're dying, but they will be replaced by things that are able to survive. What is it, like 99% of all animals that ever lived are extinct? It's some huge number. I'm not exactly sure on that number, but it doesn't take into account human ingenuity or the adaptability of humans or animals. So all these doom and gloom predictions are all essentially done from today's perspective, saying that, well, we're going to have all this horrible things happen unless we stop and change now and put in carbon taxes now.
With collective group response enforced by violence.
Right. And, yeah, so he was, like, interviewing some guy from, like, the Harvard School of Harvard that was some sort of government tool that supposedly wrote on a book on economics, and Leo was like, hey, you wrote the book on economics, who said that, yeah, you put in a carbon tax, and then people will do less carbon stuff. So I'm not saying that that's not necessarily true. You make a thing more expensive, people will find ways to either take it to the black market or put their resources into other things. But that is not a moral thing, too.
Yeah, it's weird that they want to put a tax on something that's not even a good. Like, the carbon they're talking about isn't something that somebody is even buying. It's a byproduct of some other process. So I'm not familiar with things that are a tax on a non-good. That seems kind of bizarre. I mean, a tax in general is, of course, illegitimate anyway, but it's just they're kind of taking it a step further on a non-good.
Yeah, there's a carbon tax initiative here in our home state of Washington State. I forget what it is, I-286 or something like that?
I-732.
There you go. Which is a what? It's a $25 tax on per thousand or per ton of CO2.
Right, that's supposedly offset by a bunch of tax breaks for low-income families and a reduction in the sales tax and all this other stuff.
And I'm sure, I mean, I haven't read the thing, but and some of these things are often worded fairly vaguely. So oftentimes government will make a law, and then it's up to the private sector, I mean, the people, to figure out how to comply with it. So there's now going to be a $25 tax per ton of CO2. Well, what does that mean? Who knows? So now you have to hire a lawyer. You have to hire an environmental regulation specialist person to figure out what your carbon footprint is. I don't know if, you know, what the exact penalties are going to be or how they're going to be enforced. Maybe the government's going to come in and do some sort of evaluation of your carbon footprint. I mean, what's that process going to be like? Is it going to be, are you going to be able to dispute it? Are you, what are you going to have to buy counters, like some sort of a meter system onto your exhaust pipe or onto, if you're a factory owner, onto the exhaust of your whatever? Are you going to get taxed per cow that you have? Are you taxed for every time you exhale? What is it? What, how is it going to be implemented? That's a huge, huge thing. And that's a huge cost in addition to the cost in the bill that's just not talked about, or at least that I've seen.
Yeah, now, to be fair, like, people ask us, well, how would a free market society work? And, I mean, the beauty of it is we don't have an answer. No one has an answer. It's a summation of all the voluntary interactions of people. So for us to ask for, well, how is this going to work? I don't know if it's the same corollary, but it sounded like it would be. Like,
yeah, we're not the ones that are prescribing some action, though.
Right.
That's usually when someone asks us to predict the future. Well, you can't really predict the future, but I think it's safe to say that when someone sticks a gun up to your face and says, you know, give me $25 for every ton of carbon dioxide you create, for me to say, well, are you going to let me know when I make a ton of carbon dioxide? I mean,
yeah, how are you going to measure it?
How is this thing anything being measured? Who does this apply to? Is this apply to everybody? Does this apply only to, I mean, the biggest polluter in the world is government. I'm sure that's all exempt.
Well, in this movie, government's the solution, so of course.
Right, right. Yeah, they made big deal. Like, he went to, like, the Paris talks, and he thought everything was fantastic, but he was upset that it was all left up to the countries to enforce it or not, and he was worried that it wasn't going to be enforced because he loves force. And then he went and talked to Clinton, and then he would talk to Obama and, you know, get some whatever rhetoric from those assholes. But they made him like the UN delegate on peace, environment, or something. I forget, what was his title? What was his made-up dumb title? I forget.
Yeah, something like that. It was sort of like that Harry Potter girl was for the women thing.
Yeah, it's like whenever there's some sort of a celebrity that takes a stand on some issue, they give them some title to make them feel important or something and let them have a speech on the UN floor so that they can make a movie about it or get filmed, get some press. I don't know. It's all horrific to me. If it was voluntary, that's fine. If you want to make a movie where you are talking about a thing that you think is a problem and you're making a cry for people to change their behavior, no problem with that. Go for it. I think that's fantastic. That's the free market at work. You're putting your ideas and your information out versus a whole bunch of other information and ideas, and people are going to take it and take what they think is true and apply it to their own lives. Fine. But when you think the only way to get done is through some collective force, through government action, well, then that's where you and I got to part ways there, Leo. Because you turn into the thug when you raise a gun and say that you got to stop breathing or you got to change your life this way.
Yeah, at the end of the film, they do offer suggestions, and I assume they're voluntary, and so that's all fine, just like you were saying. And they say that they offset their own carbon by buying carbon tax credits or whatever. And that's certainly a fine thing to do, so long as it's voluntary. I mean, I don't know where that money goes or what happens with it, so that's a little bit dubious. But
right.
As long as it's voluntary.
Yeah, as long as it's voluntary, it's fine. But you're talking about putting money into the most inefficient possible means, even if you believe that government can do a thing. Giving money to government to do it is the least efficient way to do that.
Yeah, and I think we've spent 25 episodes now making that case, but maybe one of our future episodes will be a more in-depth analysis of that. I know I've promised a bunch of future episodes.
That's part of the profit. That's part of the deal. We promise and we don't deliver.
Yeah, there you go.
There was one kind of NAP issue, and I don't know if we really want to get into this or not. It's probably worth getting into. I don't know. We'll find out what you think. If they could prove, if the science came out and is incontrovertible, even though there are many scientists who have refuted this 97% consensus crap that people keep saying, if they could show that the people that are with the sea level rising, and it's not tied to, you know, sun cycles, and it's not tied to just natural climate change in the world, because, I mean, everybody knows, right, that climate just changes always. It's always changing. They've heard of, like, the Ice Age, right? And they knew that back in the prehistoric times, the world was – there was so much more carbon, and trees grew a lot higher, and there were, like, things called dinosaurs that ran around. We know this, right? Okay. So let's forget all that, and let's say that the climate is some steady state thing, and then mankind comes along and changes it, makes it hotter. And there are people on the coastline that have voluntarily chosen to live on the coast, but now that the coastline is rising, they have to move or their property gets damaged or whatever. There was one line in the movie that said something like, these people are all being displaced or whatever, they're all being attacked, and it's our fault. Do you give any stock to that statement at all? That somehow your actions to create CO2 is aggressing against anybody else?
No, I mean, if that were the case, then anything could be considered an aggression against someone else. Like, any natural process could be an aggression against somebody else. Or, say, opening a competing bakery across the street from another bakery and taking half of their clientele could be considered an aggression.
Like, oh, my God. I'm sorry. Okay. I'll try and hold on to my thought. Here, go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah, so I don't agree with that. I mean, I think an individual action that causes measurable harm on an individual scale perhaps would have a an aggression component to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The thought I had, and this is probably better for off-air, what you said about that anything would be aggression reminded me of this guy on YouTube called, I think his name is Red Pill Philosophy, where he did some video, and I probably should have linked it to you at the time, where he talked about how competition was immoral. And I thought it was hilarious, but we'll have to maybe get into it some other time. I'll have to show it to you, and we'll have to watch it and see what you think. But it might be worth an episode. It might not be.
Well, it's his argument that because it causes harm, that it's bad. Because
I think so.
Harm isn't the measure.
If you were to open up, a store across the street, that you are somehow harming the other guy.
So we should all be stuck at whatever level that currently exists.
Right. We should all be at the exact same level. We shouldn't. One being better, slightly better than another, is immoral somehow. Or having to compete against somebody who's doing something better than you is somehow immoral. I'm not making this shit up, but I don't want to misconstrue his argument. So let's table this for now, and maybe I'll try and find that link for you. But it's definitely something that made me laugh.
All right. So if you don't mind, I want to go on a bit of a tirade rant, and then we can start winding this down because I'm already late for going inside.
Yes, sir. Go ahead. Tirade it up.
All right. So for the Before the Flood movie, I like how he opens with this, where one of the guys says, I don't want to be on a planet without animals, because they're talking about all these extinctions that are happening.
Right.
And I think this is rather clever that Leonardo mentions the two biggest criticisms of him going into this film, in the film, as if that diffuses them or negates them in any way. The first one is that he's just a Hollywood actor. he's not a scientist, so why should anyone listen to him? And by mentioning it, that's supposed to make it go away. Well, you know, we've argued, you and I, in the past, that it's not necessarily the messenger, it's the message. So, you know, that's not really a big deal. But then he goes on to say that he continues to use fossil fuels at a rate probably higher than most, which seems a bit hypocritical, especially when he then touts that he was on President Clinton's thing, you know, 15, 16 years ago, and yet now he's still flying around the world, and I believe, you know, a fair amount on private jets to, you know, muck up this nonsense.
To be fair, he does drive a Prius, and he has since the introduction of the Prius. But, yeah, you're right. He does fly around. He jet sets around the world, as far as I know, and clearly as the movie demonstrates.
Yeah, and then another thing I noticed was that they bring on this scientist who has apparently been discredited, and they claim that he's discredited because evil Republicans and corporations, oil corporations, want to discredit him. And that may or may not be the case. But I think it's funny to me that this is a left-leaning issue, and of course they're going to cry corruption due to the source of the funding or what have you. But then when it becomes a vaccine issue with, like, Andrew Wakefield, they'll say, oh, no, that guy's been debunked.
Mm-hmm.
When ostensibly the same thing happened. You know, vested interest in the pharmaceutical industry went out to smash him, and they're saying the same thing about the oil industry trying to smash this other guy. So that's another inconsistency that I see, or at least a parallel to an inconsistency. And so that was kind of funny to me.
Mm-hmm.
That it sounded a lot like that, but in reverse. And then, I don't know, just the whole idea that it's going to require a government solution to a problem when government is the most inefficient way to try to solve anything, it kind of ties back to the whole interstellar deal. And I'm going to post an article at the bottom of this episode posting that talks about the whole global warming hoax, as it's called in this article. And it references a bunch of the major key points that have happened over the years, like Climate Gate and the Paris Accords and the Rio Accords and all the climate stuff. So there's some good information that's going to be down below. But the opening of it is a quote from the founder of the Weather Channel. And he says, quote, "Global warming is the biggest scam in history. I am amazed, appalled, and highly offended by it." And I thought that was interesting from a guy who's, you know, probably fairly well known in that circle. So, but I'll post this down below. But they talk about the 97% consensus and how it's kind of a contrived measure, because they basically say that any study in their abstract, you know, like the summary of their study, doesn't explicitly deny global warming is occurring, is counted as supporting it. And so it's a way of jockeying the numbers or lying with statistics. And of course, science isn't done by consensus, and so the whole concept of that doesn't even make any sense. But even if it were, that number is rather inflated with how they doctored the numbers.
Right.
So I thought I had a bunch more to say, but I do have to wrap this up. So that's Interstellar and Before the Flood. And I hope we made some sense. This feels like a very disjointed episode to me. How do you feel about this one?
We're always all over the map. I don't know. It seems like we have our semi-consistent points that we keep harping on, but, you know, we usually try and hit them from slightly different angles based on what's going on. One final note about voting. I'm not going to vote. I know that there are a lot of pragmatic reasons that people use to vote. I believe that every vote is a request for subjugation, and I've said that before, I'll say it again. It's legitimizing the system. I think that the government can be ignored out of existence. It can be. It can be made obsolete, just like we don't ride around in horse and buggies anymore. Hopefully people can move past this idea that we need to violently control others. Just like slavery, once it gets in the public consciousness that slavery was immoral, once it gets in the public consciousness that government is immoral, I don't think we're necessarily going to go back to it. This ANCON idea that any hierarchy is immoral doesn't jive. Voluntary hierarchy are perfectly fine. Anyway, that I'm getting off on a tangent. Never mind. Anyway, won't be voting. Dan, are you going to vote?
No, sir. No, sir. Not at all. I agree with George Carlin. If you vote, you have no right to complain because your voice was quote-unquote heard, right?
Right.
And
yeah,
I sent
you... Like you said, I'm not gonna violently aggress against somebody because a vote isn't a suggestion. The effect of a vote is a command. So I'm not gonna violently aggress against somebody to try and tell them that violent aggression is wrong.
Right. I sent you a meme the other day, and you know it's this kid, and there's these two bullies in front of him, and it says, "If you don't pick your next bully, you have no right to complain about getting beat up."
Yeah. Excellent point.
So I thought that was cute.
Yeah, it's a perfect analogy, man. But people don't think of government as a bully, but they should. And once I think everyone realizes that, maybe we can move past this era in human history, which involves just millions of people getting slaughtered needlessly.
Well, we'll end it on a downer, Robert. Appreciate it.
Well, it's in time for the election, so I thought I'd bring it down.
Yes, yeah, so our next episode will be after the election, so I'm sure we'll have plenty of commentary about that. We might not even do a movie for that, unless there's an election-related movie that you and I could both discuss that might be interesting.
Yeah, there are such movies, but we'll probably have so much to talk about based on who wins and the backlash and the response to all it all. I mean, if Trump wins, is Cranston really going to move to Canada? I mean, if Hillary wins, just watching the whole – or if Trump wins, watching the whole media lose their shit – Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. We'll see.
Yeah, I agree. I think it will be interesting either way. And, you know, I'm just going to pop some popcorn. That's all I'm going to do.
Yeah, I'm going to try and ignore it, but it's impossible. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for joining us, folks. This might be another long one. We were the Reed Rothbard podcast. We run ReedRothbard.com, books, lectures, articles, all this other stuff on the website. We also run ReedRothbard.com. We've got the Liberty Classroom links that you probably want to start clicking those, say, right after Thanksgiving for that weekend. I'm going to save some money there. And any other needs for Black Friday, we've got Amazon links, so you can start your Christmas shopping there, and we'll get a little kickback. So we do appreciate your time, and I bid you adieu. Thank you very much.
Yeah, like us, review us on iTunes. Every little bit helps. Thanks much. Thanks for listening, guys, and have a safe election. Try and do something productive. Take care. The Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.